All right, I'd like to welcome everybody to the June Trilog meeting. I am your host, Jason Tower. We had elections last month, so before we get started, let me just take a brief moment and introduce the steering committee. Myself, Jason Tower, is chair. Rick DeNatale is public relations. Matt Fry, system administration. John Broom with his head down, treasurer. And Cristobal Palmer is our vice chair, and he is out getting your dinner. So give him a round of applause when he gets here to thank him. If I could ask everyone, please, if you have phones or pagers or whatever, put them in silent mode, just out of respect for our presenter. We have a couple of announcements. Matt has something about the open barbecue.
Hey, how's it going, everyone? Open barbecue, open jam is a live music and barbecue party for geeks and other people that's being held next Saturday afternoon at Rub Smokehouse in Morrisville. I've got some informational flyers by the donation box and by the drink, so come out to Rub's on Saturday afternoon. It officially starts at 10:30 a.m., but that's basically when we get started with the food and everything, and music will start between 11 and 12 probably, and we'll go till sunset. So hope to see everyone come out. Yes, Brian. The 17th of June, that's correct. If you go to the website, obj.org, or openbarbecueopenjam.org, you can see the menu and the music schedule and everything on there. Basically, it's a plate of food is $5, and beverages are $1, beers being $2, and there's also a kid's plate for $2, and it's going to be great. So I hope to see everyone next Saturday.
Should be a good time. Joe Tate, where'd you go? Oh, there he is. Joey has a quick announcement as well.
For anybody who has heard of Canary and what it is, or has just gotten sick and tired of RPM or Depackage as your package manager system, I have CDs of the brand newest Earned Today 4-site release, which is a great desktop operating system and is Canary based. If you're interested, that's what I want to hear.
Okay, so for a Canary CD, see Joe. If you're sick and tired of RPM or Depackage, Dan Chen, who is our speaker this evening, will be telling you all about why you will not be tired of Depackage. It's such a great thing. All right. Okay. Let's real quickly run through Have a Job, Need a Job. If anyone is looking for work and would like to raise their hand and say a few words, this would be the perfect time. 100% employment. Oh, I'm sorry. 99%.
I still have a job. However, in my best estimate, the EPA is moving away from my skill set. So if you want a winner of the CSC Federal Sector Excellence in Technology and for 2005, and related things, handy with Perl, CSC, Perl, PL SQL, and related bits and pieces, and a writer of white papers extraordinaire. It would be good, perhaps, to talk to me.
Okay, and I saw one other hand, a couple other hands.
Hi, my name is David Robinson, and I'm looking for a software test or verification job. I've got a lot of experience in telecom, and I'm good with Perl scripts and Tickle scripts. So let me know if you've got something.
All right, I have another hand back here.
Okay. I'm a recent Duke grad. I've been working just about anything. I don't really know how to do anything. I just want to help out.
Okay, anybody else? All right, flip side of the coin. Have a job. If you know of any place that is hiring, where you work or where someone else works, and I'd like to say a few words again. Anyone?
Mr. Tate? Our path is hiring for anybody who can schlep Python. Well, not anybody, but if you're good and you can schlep Python, we're interested. We're also interested in people who have strong experience with web UI design and HTML, JavaScript, those kinds of things.
All right. Anybody else? Going once.
Cisco knows a thing or two about networks, I'm told.
Okay, pizza is running just a little bit behind. We would normally do that next. We do not have a sponsor. Unfortunately, our sponsor kind of bailed on us this month. So if when you're getting a slice of yummy, scrummy pizza and sodas, if you'd like to throw a couple of bucks in the donation box at the rear of the room, it would be very much appreciated. Anybody else have any announcements? I think that's all we really have. Okay.
My forgotten item of the week is that I usually forget to mention one part of our open barbecue is that the event is being held as a charity event to sponsor the Friends of Dix, which is an organization which is trying to get the city to turn the Dorothea Dix property into like a Central Park kind of a place, Dix Park. So come out and benefit Friends of Dix. That's where our proceeds will be going. Thanks.
Okay. I see hands to the announce. Okay. Without any further ado then, Daniel Chen, a.k.a. Crimson in IRC, is going to do a little bit of discussion about the new Ubuntu release, Dapper Drake. So if you'd put your hands together for Dan.
Sorry about the background noise real quick. So. Okay, I think everybody can hear me, right? Okay. Well, as Jason was saying, my name is Daniel. My IRC handle or nickname is Crimson, C-R-I-M-S-U-N. Not much to be said about that. For those of you who are into like 1970, 1980 British progressive rock or anything, has to do with the band King Crimson, of course, but it's more directly from a Dream Theater song called A Change of Seasons. But, of course, that's just random trivia that you probably didn't want to know anyway. But I'm here tonight to talk a little bit about our latest release, our being Ubuntu's latest release, which is called Dapper Drake, or correctly, it's known as 6.06 LTS, the LTS part standing for long-term support. And Dapper Drake, of course, is a code name which can refer to ducks or dragons or ponies, surprisingly enough. That kind of came in late in the release as our FTP archive masters started screaming and doing random stuff because we were all very, very stressed out. But anyway, I will cover a few things about our latest release tonight, and just to jump in, I will start with some background about the distro itself. The question is, what exactly is Ubuntu? And it might be best if we started off in the vocabulary. It's an ancient but still very, very current word from Africa that has lots and lots of different semantics, the most important one probably being an inclusive one known as I am because you are. In other words, we start off with this community idea from the very get-go. And if you were here in the fall and were present for Jeff Wall's presentation on the Breezy Badger Tour, you will probably remember, or if you don't remember, I'll refresh you really quickly, The idea behind Ubuntu is that we were all sitting around one day and discussing names for this particular distribution, and one of the names that was brought up was called Cockfosters, and that was decided that it was probably not the right one to use. So we went with this one that Mark Shuttleworth, our benevolent dictator, so to speak, our boss, told us about, because it implies this idea of us all being in the same boiling pot together. Now, with that said, it is a catalyst for positive global change. We want to use this distribution not to take over the world or anything, but to provide a tool set for people to use, both in underprivileged countries and in, you know, privileged countries. But we want it to be a catalyst for something that you can use to help other people around you, in addition to yourself. It is, of course, based on the Debian GNU Linux operating system, which means that it carries all the historical baggage of Debian. That's interesting, because the reason it exists is because of about 6 or 7 Debian developers broke away and decided that the release process was getting a little too long in the tooth, we'll just say. If any of you know about Debian releases, it generally takes somewhere between 10 to 12 months to actually get a release out the door, and that's optimistic. One of the running jokes is that Debian releases, because they're stable, won't ever actually release, which, well, there's some truth to that, too. But the reason that Ubuntu exists is because we want a timed release schedule. Every 6 months, we'll be putting out a new refresh, so to speak. This refresh could be major, it could be minor. We've had, so far, these releases. We've had one in October of 2004, we've had one in April 2005, one in October 2005, and, if you notice, one in June 2006. Well, if you scratch your head, you're like, well, that's not really a 6 month release cycle, is it? Well, the previous ones were 6 month release cycles, but this one, because it's, quote, long-term support, we need the 3 to 5 year support plan. Therefore, we want to get some more polish in the distribution. That's Mark Shuttleworth's big thing. Mark, if you guys are familiar with, is connected with Thought and sold off Thought to VeriSign for a huge amount of money and then went off and, you know, took a spaceship and did random stuff like that. And then he turned around and founded Canonical, which is the parent company of Ubuntu. So, what are the two major points of Ubuntu? First of all, everybody, regardless of disability, should be able to use this distribution in your native language right away. You shouldn't have to go through some huge installer process. It shouldn't necessarily have to be text-based, and you shouldn't have to press enter and up and down arrows all the time. You should be able to use, like, a fairly modern computer and get it up and running. Well, okay, if you don't have a fairly modern computer, that's okay, too. We have stuff that works with that. And also, it should be free, and this is the heritage from Debian. Because Debian is very strong and very, very persistent about following their so-called free software guidelines, when you have this history of coming from Debian, the developers from Debian, you want to make sure that anything you distribute can be modified and therefore turned around and distribute some more. So, two key points. It has to be free and it has to be immediately usable for a novice user or a power user, doesn't really matter, in your local language of choice, regardless of whether you have disabilities or not. Something that's introduced with this particular round is a long-term support plan, which I'll talk about later. And I think our food's in the back,
yeah,
so.
Thank you.
Has everybody gotten pizza yet? All right, well, if everybody has, most everybody's already gotten pizza, I will pick back up. Again, I'm Daniel, if you came in late, and I'll be talking about the latest release of Ubuntu, which is codenamed Dapper Drake, or as we call it, 6.06, long-term support, or just LTS. And very quickly, I've just talked about, you know, some real elementary stuff, like why it came about, why it exists, what the name means, what sets it apart from Debian, which is where we came from, namely the release schedule, the timely release schedule. And the fact that this go-around, we've started offering two different flavors, and that ties into the support period. And so, very quickly, who actually makes this distribution? And like most open source software that's made up of thousands of developers that are spread out around the world, most of the people are spread out all around the world. The only difference is the entire team is about a dozen people. That is, we have a lot of people who are in Germany. We have a lot of people who are in the UK. We have a couple of people that are in Australia or in New Zealand. We've got one person based out of the U.S. And, you know, somewhere else, I think we have a couple of people that are out of South Africa. But it's a very, very small team. It's only about a dozen people. And those are the paid people. Everybody else is basically a contributor, which means that we're everywhere. That means you guys are contributors, potential contributors as well, and obviously you're here. So the people who actually make up Ubuntu, the distribution team, would be the people like our release manager, Matt Zimmerman, who came from Debian, Mark Shuttleworth, who founded it, obviously, and provides all the funding for it out of his really, really, really deep pockets. And we have a couple of Janes who are based out of South Africa, and, of course, some Daniels that are based out of Germany, and, like I was saying, you and me. And I'll get to the you and me part in a little bit. The parent company of Ubuntu is called Canonical. That's the company that Mark founded and provides the funding for the actual development of the distribution. And then there's a nonprofit part that's called the Foundation, which means that basically they're just going to make sure that Mark doesn't try to take over and push it off into some direction that's going to sell out to Microsoft. Well, if he hadn't sold out to one evil company, I probably wouldn't be doing this. But, well, you know. So, and then there are a couple of groups that actually come out of the Ubuntu team, the community team, that is, and comprise the technical board and their various community councils. The technical board actually makes all the development decisions, like what are we going to do for this next release cycle? What types of things are we going to spec out and actually implement? Where are we going to actually hold our developer conferences? So far we've had a developer conference down under in Australia. We've had one in Montreal. And the one that's coming up will be in Paris. So, fun, if you like that. The community council is actually made up of members from the community, which decide, your level of contribution to the distribution is significant enough so that we're going to give you a certain amount of privileged access so that you can continue contributing. I'm actually one example that has gone through the community council. I became a member and then became a maintainer, and then now I'm one of the core developers of it, which basically means that I spent a whole lot of time helping people, and then I spent a whole lot more time helping people, and then I spent even more time helping people, and then I spent a whole lot of time helping people, which basically means that I'm spending a whole lot of time helping people and learning a whole lot about it, which is really cool, but at the same time, there's potential for angry users and stuff like that, as we'll get to in a very little bit. And then, of course, we have various mailing lists, just like most distributions do. And then we have chat rooms, like many Linux distributions do. And then forums, like the Ubuntu forums. And then the blogs, various web blogs. But where do the blogs actually come in? Well, for instance, if you're just kind of anticipating trying out Ubuntu, and then you find out that it eats your system, and you're very angry, somehow this is going to get back to the developers. Like, we're going to hear word of it, and then we're going to go and help you out. Of course, if you're threatening to sue us, that's probably not the best way to get help, but life works that way sometimes, right? Who uses the actual distribution? Schools do. Businesses, governments, grandmothers, believe it or not, and actually toddlers. We have a fair number of children who are actually using the educational version of Ubuntu, which is called EDUbuntu, or EduBuntu, if you want to call it that. And they seem fairly pleased with it when it's not exploding in their faces. Again, why would you want to use this? Because if you've ever come out of one of the more seasoned distributions, like I started way back with Slackware, or maybe way back, if you want to call it that, and messed around with Red Hat, and messed around with Debian, and messed around with SUSE, and I don't know, I've been through a lot. I haven't messed with Gentoo yet. But...
Gentoo messes with you.
Yeah, probably. We have a fair number of members that like to heckle. That's all right. So if you have experience going through a text-based installer or, you know, compiling the various bootstrap portions of your distribution in order to get, you know, a web browser running so you can check your email, then you know there's some pain involved in actually doing what you want to do. Well, I'm sure that my grandmother, if she were still alive, would not want to go through and mess with the new C compiler and install kernel headers, and then compile, you know, a network driver just so that she could get online. She probably wouldn't want to do that. She probably, if she were to use a computer with a CD-ROM, she would probably want to take a single disk, put it in her drive, start up the computer, and have it install. And in a matter of, 15 to 20 minutes, depending on the speed of the computer, she should be able to check her email via a web browser, let's say Firefox. Well, that's one of the goals of the distribution. You should be able to get up and running immediately, be productive immediately. And another reason why some people want to use this distribution is because they know that Debian, being some very, very strong proponents of, well, we're not going to release until it's stable, there's a tradition of stability and security commitment coming out of it. And, of course, if you're not satisfied with that, if you're not satisfied with the community support you can get, you can pay for support, which is, well, not too much different from a lot of different companies. And then if you're big into certifications, you can look at the flashy names, like it's certified by IBM to run DB2, or it's certified by MySQL, and so on and so forth. But the real question here for most of you guys is, why should I run it? Why should I look at it? Well, it does have extended support. What does extended support mean? That means if you're going to install a desktop flavor of it, you'll get 3 years of support. If, however, you just want to set up, like, a web development environment, you might want to use the server. The server flavor is supported for 5 years. By the way, you don't pay any money for that support, unless you want to go with the accountability factor in which you can call somebody up at 3 o'clock in the morning and yell at them. Thankfully, I'm not that person that's going to be on the other end of the phone answering. But if you want that type of accountability, you can always pay for support.
Hey, Dan, well, before yes. you go on, would you mind defining what Debian or Ubuntu means by support?
Yes. By support, we mean security fixes. And as of today, actually, we will be considering adding new versions of software to the stable repositories. Originally, our very first release, which was codenamed Wardy and released in October of 2004, we followed the Debian support pattern in which if there were security issues that came out, we would only backport those fixes and we wouldn't add any additional functionality. And that's been the case through our previous releases. But in the case of our latest one, we'll be supporting newer versions as well that will be backported. The most significant one is probably going to be like Firefox, for instance. We released with version 1.5.03, I think, and .4 was released, so our Firefox maintainer is going to backport that, which is a huge headache if you guys have done any package maintenance before. Any other questions about the support?
Once we're talking about the versions being backported, say for example, I'm running the server using MySQL 4.1 on Dapper.
Right.
Does that mean if MySQL 4.2 comes out, it's going to automatically jump me up, or are the package naming conventions going to be in such a way that it won't upgrade my server in that kind of way?
Well, one of the things that comes out of Debian is that when you're using the package management utilities, you are not ever automatically upgraded. You have to explicitly choose to upgrade. So if you're using MySQL 4.1, you know, when you update, you're not going to get automatically shoved into 4.2, which is pretty important if you're approaching this from an enterprise perspective. Because there could be like lots of ABI breakage. You don't want your application just blowing up.
My question is more along the lines of, say, a week after 4.2's release, there's a security vulnerability in 4.1.4.2. Is 4.1 still going to be supported by a security vulnerability?
Yes. It will be, I mean, whatever is in the actual archive when the distribution flavor is released is going to be supported for either 3 or 5 years. Any other questions? Okay. I will address some more support issues later on. But, of course, if you're not really, really pleased by the ugly brown color, you can also choose other themes. Or, if that's not enough, you can use the KDE-based version of Ubuntu called Kubuntu, which I think a few people are running. And if you have young children and want them to actually get into, let's say, you know, mathematics or spelling or anything like that, you can use Edubuntu. And that one is targeted toward younger children and middle schoolers, and not so much high schoolers and on up, because it's, well, by then you should have a fairly good grasp of what you're looking at. And one of the things that we introduced last go-round with our previous release is Zubuntu, which is based on another alternate desktop environment called XFCE. And it's targeted toward older machines or machines with slightly lower requirements. Like, if you don't necessarily like the footprint that GNOME or KDE have, you might want to give Zubuntu a try.
Daniel?
Yes.
Earlier you talked about putting a CD in and having it just go.
Mm-hmm.
Are you expecting, intending, whatever, that CD is capable of distinguishing between your toggle-wise file and your less capable machine, and therefore automatically choosing Ubuntu?
That's a question that's actually been discussed, but not really been spec'd out or implemented, because it requires a little bit more installer magic to go through for the technical side. But we're getting to the point where enough people, because the real difference between each of these derivatives is what actually comes on the CD, we're getting to the point where people want to say, well, look at my hardware when I insert the CD and tell me or suggest what I should, you know, use. There are a couple of quirks with that. First of all, it's a one CD distro, where Mark is really, really emphatic about trying to keep it so that you don't have to download extra stuff just to have a usable desktop. You should be able to get everything off that one CD. And KDE and GNOME and XFCE will not fit on one CD. That's kind of like a technical gotcha. But another thing is, we kind of want people to come along, and if you feel an itch, just go ahead and scratch it. Like, if you want to put E17, Enlightenment 17 snapshots and make a new derivative, you can. You should be able to go and do that. But in terms of your question.
This then presumes that your person installing, that installer rather than the electronic installer, does have some concept of where they're going and how to get there.
Right. There is work on an automated part, like if you're familiar with Debian's FAI stuff, the fully automated stuff, or if you're looking at Kickstarter, you know, any of those traditions, there's a lot of work being done on that. I don't know if it's personally, I don't know if it's going to get into our next release, which will be in October, but there definitely is work on it. Yes.
I believe I have a Bluetooth live TV, mm-hmm. and I put it in my camera. What kind of laptop that unfortunately there was no use? What kind of thing?
Well, I will attempt to address that from this perspective. I'm not exactly privy to the original decision to leave it out of the seeds that form the CD, but I will say that of our core developers, one of them uses Emacs. That may have something to do with it. The other thing that might have something to do with it is the fact that Emacs is considered an operating system by itself. So I don't know. We really only want one operating system running on that CD. So, I mean, seriously, I don't know the reason why, but originally the target was you shouldn't have to use VI, you shouldn't have to use Emacs. We're going to give you GNU Nano, you know. So it's a little easier to use for beginners. So it's not, we're VI-centric or we're anti-Emacs. It's, we're choosing to use something that's a little bit easier than both of them.
To some people.
To some people. Well, there are... Yes. Yes. There are some other reasons why you should want to use it. It should just work. You should be able to just put it in there and, you know, barring the few people who want to use Emacs right off the get-go, you should be able to come up with a nice, pretty desktop if you're not too anti-Brown, that is. It should just work. But, of course, this is software, and we're all familiar with software bugs, and things will break. So, when things break, there's a bug tracker. Now, the bug tracker, which is named Launchpad, comes out of a Bugzilla married with the old Debian email text-based kind of bug tracking system. So what we have here is hopefully something that takes the best parts of both but omits the really bad parts. As we'll see, that's not really the case because right now if you search for the newest bugs, you'll actually get the oldest bugs. And if you try to search for the oldest bugs, you get the newest bugs. Well, that's open source development for you, which is, you know, they refresh every week. So hopefully it'll be addressed next week when we get to it. But we do have a nice, pretty, semi-intuitive bug tracker which you can fire away your bugs like. Emacs is not installed by default. Why? And then put lots of exclamation points after it. You could do that. Or you can say things like, well, the installer ate my NTFS partition. Why? Where did it break? Why did it break? And give me my money back. And then we'll just say, well, you didn't pay any money for it. I'm sorry. But most importantly, Ubuntu is a distribution for people to get involved in. Not just, okay, I want to use something that's going to be usable right away. I want to feel good about it. I want to say, look, this thing broke for me, and I was able to contribute back to it, and I was able to help fix it. Or you might spend a lot of time helping other people. Or you might spend time writing documentation, which nobody really seems to like to do. Or you might actually step in and help maintain software packages. So there are a lot of reasons to actually try out the distribution. How do you use it? Well, it's pretty simple. You either download it. We offer BitTorrent. You can download it from any of the other mirrors. Or you can get it shipped to you. ShipIt is the name that's actually paid for out of Mark's own pocket, in which you can order lots and lots of CDs if you really wish, and they'll ship them to you for free. This started way back with the first release in which we had somebody that ordered something like 10,000 CDs, and they actually got them, got 10,000 CDs. Of course, I think that person was the only one who got 10,000 CDs, because after that, they put a cap on it. Now you can get 5 copies shipped of either Kubuntu or Edubuntu or the straight Ubuntu, but you can go back and keep ordering 5s until you get to, you know, some reasonable limit. They're not going to let you just keep repeating until you get to 10,000. But the idea is, if you don't have adequate, meaning broadband connection, they'll give you a copy for free. And it comes in a very nice package and stuff like that. There are actually three different flavors of the installer. There's a graphical installer, which comes on the live CD, and I'll be demonstrating that later. There's a text-based one, which is using the original Debian installer, or we call it DI. It's ncurses-based. And the server installer is also DI-based, so it's also text-based. The difference between the alternate and the server installers is that the server installer, by default, will set you up with a LAMP stack. You'll get Apache, MySQL, and PHP done. You don't have to do anything, really. You just press enter a couple times. And, of course, if you're really into, like, the newest Spark hardware and stuff, you can do a netboot, and you can install it there, too. We've actually got a considerable amount of work done on that. So what does it actually look like? I don't know if anybody wants to cut the lights or something. But. Okay. This is what the live CD looks like. When you... Can most people get a pretty good view of this? Okay. Well, when you boot off the CD, this is what the live CD, the graphical installer, which is what they will ship to you if you use ship it and request a bunch of CDs. This is what they'll ship to you. Now, a lot of work was actually put into this graphical boot process and stuff, and I'll talk about that a little. We had all the artwork contributed by some guy in the Netherlands, and it was pretty much done in the week before release, the artwork, that is. So, you know, if you have an itch to scratch, that might be something you want to look at. Again, that's one guy, and he did the Ubuntu logo, and it got in, and it's potentially looked at by lots and lots of people. But from the live CD menu, you can actually run the live CD, or you can choose to install it from within the GNOME environment. You can also do the standard tests for, like, bad memory and bad CD burns and stuff like that, or you can just boot straight off the hard disk. But we're probably most interested in just looking at how it installs.
Safe graphics mode will be lowest power design.
Yeah. The screen that you're looking at now is in user space completely. A lot of different distributions use a kernel-based boot splash or something. This was written completely in user space. It's called USplash. And one of the reasons why the guys chose to use user space is because they really didn't want to have to mess with the kernel internals all the time. So we have a couple of people that are really, really adamant about shoving stuff into user space if at all possible, and that's one of the reasons why it's there. I don't know how many of you have actually tried out the live CD, but it's actually one of the fastest live CDs out there. So, you know, if you want to challenge that, you can always download one and try it, yes.
Do you have time for a question going back to early in your presentation?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Early on, you said we've got support, we've got websites, you said blogs, chat rooms, forums, email. I'm in an organization called RTPNet now, and we website host for nonprofits.
Right.
And we're fussing internally among ourselves on the board. How are we going to communicate with each other? And we're fussing about, well, what can we do to help our member organizations communicate within their own groups or with other groups? Can you discriminate as to why you have a blog, why you have a forum, do people differentiate how they use them, things like that?
Yes. There is actually a fairly critical distinction between them in that most developers will use the mailing list for development and communication and stuff like that. And I guess that just comes out of the Debian tradition. It's very mailing list or gateway to Usenet based. The users, and everyone's a potential user, including the developers, so we all basically are getting our feet wet in the forums as well, which is where a lot of the people who are coming from Windows or OS X are posting their problems or their solutions or their tips and facts and so on and so forth. But the idea is for all of these things to basically coalesce. We don't want to get to the point where if you post on a blog, you're not going to get any help. It shouldn't matter whether you post on a forum or on your own blog. We're kind of jacking off Google's capability right here because it allows us to search all this stuff. And so eventually we shouldn't be discriminating.
Search on your own desktop or search in the great wide world?
The great wide world.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sweet. Oh, this happens a lot. On Dell's. I'll reboot it for a second. It actually does boot up on here. I tried it before.
Now we can see that support jump back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're a more seasoned user and you just really don't want to go through this stuff, you can use the alternate installer, which is text-based, and choose the slightly hidden option called Server, which installs just the base, and then you can do whatever you want. So if installing a complete desktop is not what you want, and installing a LAMP stack is not what you want, you can always just use that option. And it will give you about a 300-megabyte base system. Yes.
425 megabytes. Okay. But it's the same disk. You make the server, you grab the same disk as you would for the workstation. Could it differ?
For the alternate. There's no server option on the live CD because there's only a graphical installer. But if you use the alternate installer, to install a desktop, that is, you can choose that server option. Which is slightly confusing because there's an actual server, ISO, and then there's this hidden option called server. And so one of those will be renamed very, very soon. There is no server option on the server distro. Sorry, not.
The server ISO versus right. The server option on alternate.
What's the difference? The LAMP stack, which is installed by default on the server ISO, so it's actually meant to be supported for 5 years, whereas the live CD and the alternate text-based installers are both desktop installers.
If they still install LAMP?
No, only the server ISO installs LAMP. So sometimes we have hardware that doesn't really work like we want it to.
You don't have the little circle anymore?
The little circle. Oh, the spinner is in the regular desktop installer.
There it is.
So this is what you're looking at when you boot up a live CD. And there's been a lot of work to try and clean up the interface so it's not very confusing. And one of the things that really went into that work for the menus this go-around was to try and clean up all the stuff that basically gets dumped into the menus. These are pretty standard options you'd expect to see in an applications menu, but if you notice, there's generally just one option for most of these. And that is because Ubuntu is a best-of-breed distribution. We take the open source software out in the community and we polish it up and basically try and make it work well together. And then there's this really cool tool that I'll get to later, which allows you to add and remove software, which we have in different sections of our online repository. But you shouldn't really have to worry about all that because you should just be able to use this tool. Now, what you're probably interested in is looking at these icons. Why would we have icons on the desktop otherwise? Well, there's a package called example content, which has examples for everything that we ship. So if you want to look at a video, you would look at this video, for instance. Or if you want to work with, let me see here, this touchpad's a little... It will not play DVDs right out of the box. It's similar to Fedora Core and Red Hat in which you have to go out and actually install a package to do that, and that's for technical and potentially legal reasons.
It will play an unencrypted DVD.
Yes. But if you're talking about a CD that you just got from Netflix or Best Buy or something like that, no, you have to do a little more work.
Speaking of the video that you were just pointing
at, yeah.
How is that on this machine with the live CD?
I've never tried it, so we should find out.
That is one aspect of Ubuntu, but it will have various aspects. Ubuntu does not mean that people should not enrich the kernel. The question, therefore, is, are you going to do so in order to enable the community around you to be able to improve? These are the important things in life. But if one can do that, you have done something very important which will be appreciated.
Did I address your question?
Yes.
Okay.
So it plays right off the CD, and it plays fairly well. Let's see if we can close that. But the example content package has lots and lots of different things. You have different pictures that you can modify and open office documents and so on and so forth. And all of these are user contributed. So how do we actually install it? Click this installer icon. And it will ask you a few questions, one of which you can't see because of the screen resolution. Does this projector go up any higher?
It will, but if I use a restart
extra. Do you have it enough?
Same problem where you have to restart it.
Okay. See if I can do dual right here. You guys can't see that at all. That doesn't help. Okay. Well, we'll just have to work our way around it, I guess. And Kevin, do you want to come up here and restart it? Do you want to restart it?
If you want, like you said, you have to have it.
No, you need to restart the laptop.
No, you have to restart the laptop for this?
Yeah, it's the same problem we ran into at UNC, where you have to start the laptop without the projector plugged in first to get the resolution.
You know, on my Mac, it just works.
Well, I don't know if many people who will actually be installing a desktop system while plugged into a projector. That's a fairly minimal use case. But for people like John who really, really want to rub it in, that's okay.
The underlying problem is it basically does a DVC probe of
right.
the projector and it doesn't know I can't serve. Maybe we should file that as a bug and that means the DVC support system.
Yes, and actually that's the, I should answer that by saying that there's work in Debian to fix that. And so we're working alongside them with that. Yeah. Okay, so we probably want to choose English. I wish you could really see the bottom of the installer, so.
Ah, the world has measles!
But not.
Yeah, you actually need more.
Go ahead and leave that one.
So we will just say it's in. No, I probably don't want it, Vanna. Yeah, I'm trying to find the. You mean the actual installer? Okay. Right. Well, anyway, nobody's really. So. No, you can't quite do that yet. Sorry. Let me log out real quick. Right, that's why I don't want to
show what it looks like after it's done.
Well, the interesting... Oh, sorry. Don't want that. Whatever you have modified will end up on your system. So if it's called persistence. So if you have this icon right here that you messed with before you installed it and you put it on the desktop, or if you dragged more icons over, or if you edited a document and then put it on your desktop or whatever, whatever you have on your live CD at that point before you started the installer is what you'll get on your actual hard drive. You can't install from USB drives and thumb drives, sorry. You can't install from USB thumb drives yet, but you can install two USB thumb drives.
If you install two USB thumb drives, is there a way of handling VAR so it isn't written to
like when I have a RAM disk or something?
Actually, under Dapper, bar run
and bar lock. TempFS, yes.
Yeah, but bar log is where all the shit gets written to.
Right.
After
you can. Yeah, or basically you can just mount it on top of it. Over, it doesn't really matter. But there's no automated way to do that, if that's what you're asking. You could file a blog. Well, yeah, but the whole entire process of getting new features in would be to file a bug, and then someone will come and market a wish list item, and so that's how they get implemented. Yes, you had a question. Okay, like this icon right here, this add remove icon, I accidentally dragged over from the applications bar. That will actually appear on the desktop after you install it, if I were to actually go through the installer. So whatever I do before I use the installer, that persistence gets carried over into the actual installed desktop. Well, yes, it will install OpenOffice and X because those are all part of the live CD. So whatever you have running right now is going to actually be installed. Yes. In other words, let's suppose you went and you chose one of the applications that you wanted to do install.
Email.
You can install them, yes, because it's Casper is how the file system is actually named, but it's all done based on CAL, copy on write. So whenever you change something, it gets written out to the disk if you choose to install it. I mean, the only thing that you can't do with this live system is install a newer kernel and then reboot into the newer kernel. That's the only thing you can't do. But essentially, if you wanted to run a LAMP stack off of a live CD, you could do it. I don't know why you would want to, but you could. But I think I'm just about done with the live demonstration of this part, because I think everybody knows how to click buttons and get through an installer. But notice how this gives you a list of common applications, and so you don't really have to search through stuff. So this is really nice for people who aren't necessarily familiar with everything right off the bat. But if you do know what you want to look for, you can check these buttons, which will allow you to install yet more software. And if you really want non-free software, like VMware, for instance, apparently my microphone doesn't like Emacs. But you can actually install the VMware player from a certain part of our repository. And the technical details will all be masked from you. You just get it on your system. Does anybody else have any questions about the live installer? Again, if you install the VMware player, it will be copied onto your hard drive. Like, you'll get exactly what you messed with. Yes, and that requires me to delve in a little bit of the details on how we handle packages. Debian has a repository of about 17,000 different packages, and they basically break it down into, at the very top level, stuff that can be distributed in the United States and stuff that can't be distributed in the United States. And beyond that, they have stuff that's completely free. You can do whatever you want to it. And then they have stuff that comes from outside vendors, which is open source. The source code is provided, but the license might not be, such that it agrees with everything in terms of being free. And that one's called Contrib. And everything that is not open source does not include source code can be dumped into the non-free portion. So as we look at it here, we can have stuff that cannot be distributed in the United States that does not have source code, and that would be in the non-US repository in the non-free section. How many of you actually got that? Okay. See, most people will understand that if they've been around computers for a while and they have to use that. But my grandmother would have no idea what I'm talking about. So the idea is give someone a menu. I don't really like OpenOffice. I want to install the KDE version of KOffice or something like that. Okay, well, I happen to know what it is, so I type it in the search bar. It comes up, and I click it, and it installs. Or I'm migrating from something like Fedora Core or Debian or something, and I know the name of the package that I'm looking for, or the just the general name of the software. I can type it in there, and it'll bring it up for me and install it. So what we have here in Ubuntu is something called main, which is everything that's supported for 3 or 5 years. And then we have universe, which is everything that's basically in Debian at the time that we took the snapshot for at the beginning of each development cycle. And then we have something called multiverse. So the way it works is main is supported for 3 to 5 years. This is where all the core developers concentrate all their efforts because we have to support it. That is, you know, program updates, security updates, and things like that. And then universe is everything else out there that's free but is in Debian. Okay, so we import that. Multiverse is things like VMware and so on and so forth, which does not have available source code, which we also include in our repositories just for convenience. Yes. MythTV is in multiverse for a couple of reasons. First of all, when it was imported from its external site, which is Debian, it wasn't sitting in the place where our FTP masters thought it could be distributed. So the decision on where a source package goes is actually decided by the archive team. And to drill down even further, the reason that MythTV, for any of you guys that actually use it, the reason it's in multiverse is because it links again against packages. It builds against packages that are in multiverse. Things like FFmpeg are in universe, but things like some of the encoding features, like MP3s and stuff, those are not in universe. Yes?
Can you cache those packages on a thumb drive?
Yes, you can.
How does that work?
Okay, there are a couple of, where are you going with the cache?
Let's assume, for example, that one wants to have Emacs and not pull down all 100,000 megs every time.
Oh.
So you add an update to do this most one. You know, otherwise, I think it's you're going to run it off the live TV all the time.
Right.
Because you've got an old crappy laptop. How does that use case work out? You've got a thumb drive so you can.
Okay, so you're just going to be running it off thumb drive?
Yes.
Okay.
Installing it off thumb drive.
You can't install it off the thumb drive, but you can install to a thumb drive, in which case, yes, if you installed it using the live CD, it would still appear there on your actual thumb drive.
I'm asking if you ran the live CD, but downloaded it to Mac on the thumb drive.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It was the option from the live CD to do that.
To just download it onto the... Okay. I don't believe it's that flexible because all the stuff that's sitting in RAM is where you would install it. Like if I were to install Emacs right now, install it in RAM. If I installed that onto the thumb drive, like I just took this snapshot and installed it, then it would appear on the actual thumb drive. But I cannot choose to actually say only install Emacs onto the thumb drive. What you can do is save your user settings. And if you're really sly, you could say, okay, I just want to save my Emacs user settings, and all 20-some megs of Emacs would be saved.
Okay.
So there's a way to do it, but it's not the usual way that you're thinking of, no.
And the question I thought I was hearing to begin with was, if I
I'm on a fat pipe, can I download all of the packages that would comprise Emacs, not unpack them, but download them into some portable device and carry that to a place with a skinny pipe or a wet noodle and use that as the source?
No, but what you could do is carry that package of Emacs around, and then after you finish booting or whatever, you can just plug it in, and then what you can do is choose to install those packages, and it will just install.
That's what I'm saying. Can you use that as a source for installing?
Oh, okay. Sorry. When you say source, I think of source repositories, which is where we upload source. But you're thinking of actual, like, packages where we install the packages.
Can a USB stick be a repo?
Yes. Anything can be a repo, actually, that stores. Yes.
So the next question is, how do you add point that add an update that you attach to a USB stick?
What you probably don't want to do is what you're thinking of. What you want to do is plug in your thumb drive, and it will pop up a window, and it will have a list of packages right there. And so what you can do is just double-click on it, and it will bring up an application that will install the dependencies for you. And what you then have it to do is point your sources.list at the actual thumb drive. See what I'm saying? It's not automated in the way that you think about it, but you can do it.
Hey, I can register.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's installed to the hard drive from the thumb drive.
Right.
Perhaps we could let Daniel get on, and we'll save the how to.
Yeah, you probably want to just. You probably want to ask me the questions afterwards. So. Right. Excuse me. Yes, you could. You could do that too. But I think some of the things, yes.
You were talking earlier about being able to have an alternative to OpenOffice by downloading KDE. If I'm in, let's say, Ubuntu, KDE version, and I want to pull down a product that's specifically focused towards, say, GNOME, maybe Banshee or F-Stop, how much work has been done on integrating applications into Ubuntu and vice versa?
When you say integration, do you mean look and feel or just whether they can run?
Let's start with whether they can run.
Okay, they will be able to run because it will pull down all the dependencies. And that just comes from the Debian package management system. So, apt or Synaptic or any apt front end will actually pull down all that stuff for you. All that work is done by the maintainers, so you never had to worry about that. In terms of look and feel, if you're using KDE and you pull in a GTK application, that's done automatically. So it'll look similar to it, just because of the theming engine that KDE uses for GTK applications. On the other hand, if you're sitting in GNOME and you want to pull in, say, Amarok, you won't get that same level of integration just because GTK doesn't have a Qt theming engine. But it certainly did well. I know Kevin just pulled in Amarok, and it ran fine. Yes.
How friendly is this?
And that's exactly where I'm going to turn to Jason, so he can, if you want to demonstrate some.
We're going to go through the bootstrap first or not?
Yeah, do that. Although I can probably do that later, because the Zen stuff will be more interesting.
All right, I'm just going to take a couple minutes and just demonstrate how to run this on a Xen, as a Xen virtual domain. Let me pull up a shell and hope like hell we have net access on this after a live install. So I have a Xen server. Sweet.
Daniel had actually done a live update with the packages list earlier.
38.7. three-letter password, by the way. Just kidding. All right, so this is a Zen server that is running Fedora Core 5, running a couple of Trilog tests, virtual Zen machines. Both of these are actually running Dapper, so we could connect to any of these. XM console, Trilog, Okay, so we are now looking at the console of a Dapper virtual machine. So it's running on a 2 gigabyte loopback mounted file system with, I think, a 128 megs of RAM in the... All right, that doesn't look very good. Good Lord. So 128 megs of RAM running in this. The way this was created was from a Dapper normal full install using the debootstrap command, which allows you to basically put a Dapper system onto some file system. In this case, I used DD to create a 2 gigabyte just raw file, put a file system on it, loopback mounted it, and then when you run debootstrap, you simply say, all right, debootstrap Dapper into /MNT, and it will download all the files, extract them, slap them in there, and when you're done, you basically have a root file system that contains the elements that you need to run the system. Oh, I'm in the wrong... Detach. There we go. All right. So this is an example of what we have. This is simply a bunch of 2 gigabyte files and some swap files too. And I could loop back mount any of these. Dapper test img 2. All right. So you can loop back mount this file to a mount point, just the same way you would loop back mount an ISO, for example.
So out of the box Dapper comes then aware?
No, it has, out of the box Dapper doesn't the first or Dapper doesn't the first damn thing about Zen. I'm sure the packages are available. I happen to be running a Zen server on Fedora Core 5, just because it has the nicest, cleanest out of the box Zen 3 implementation. So all I've done is populated this file system using the debootstrap command and put the Dapper files in there. Now, once that has been done, there's still several steps that you have to go through in order to get a working system. All right, the installer does things like put the appropriate entries in etcfs tab, set a host name, set up your networking, set up your apt repositories, and so on and so forth. So there's about half a dozen steps or so that you have to go through after you've populated a file system with the bootstrap before you can have a working file system. I believe this is basically the same process you go through if you wanted to make a virtual machine with UML. Jason, could you, is that correct? Faulkner? Is that correct? It's basically the same way you do it with, like, UML or something?
I have no idea. I work on UML.
Oh, well, you work with something.
So.
Oh, all right. Well, forget that then. You're useless. At any rate, making a Zen virtual machine with Dapper is as easy as it is with any other version of Debian. If you ever use the debootstrap command, that's the real gist of it. There's lots of Google Docs available for it. Just check on debootstrap and you'll find a whole lot of how-tos. Yes.
One point I wanted to point out about doing the bootstrap on Fedora, you can actually get the Dapper debootstrap package from the Ubuntu mirror or any Ubuntu mirror, and just download it and unpackage it and run a make install, because it's really all the scripts anyway, but you'll need the updated package because it has the
Turn on.
Debootstrap Dapper script in the user-lib debootstrap directory. If you just download like a debootstrap RPM or something, so it'll install in Fedora for you, you won't get the right scripts. You'll get SARS and Woody and other things that you really don't want. So go out to the Ubuntu mirror and get the debootstrap package that's listed in the Dapper directory, which is in Universe, I think.
So anyway, if you've gone through the debootstrap process and you get it, after you populate it and you make a few minor changes, boom, you can then boot it, and now we are booting a DOMU, or an unprivileged domain, inside of Xen. And once this comes up, we'll be running a third instance of Dapper on a Fedora Core 5 system, and it's perfectly happy, happy as can be, not a single problem.
Right.
So. This is booting off. Actually, I'm booting the Dapper file system from a Fedora Core 5 Xen U kernel.
Thank you.
I just do that for easiness. It works easily. I could have gotten a Dapper Xen kernel, but then I have to compile it, and I'm too freaking lazy to do that. So I just use an FC5.
You don't have to install a Dapper kernel in your Dapper VM. You can boot off of the Fedora 5 Xen U kernel.
Right. It's just that step was missed for me.
Right. And you'll need to copy lib modules into your Dapper VM to get that to work properly.
In fact, if you look, I am running inside of my domain U right now in /boot. There's no kernel. All right, this file system has no kernel inside of it. All right, the only reason a normal system has that is so the bootloader can read it, load it into RAM, and then run it. All right, we're using Xen to basically act as the bootloader, and that takes care of this whole process. So the kernel actually shows up in FC Xen. So this is the config file for the domain that I just booted, and you'll see we're actually using a Fedora Core 5 kernel and initial RAM disk. But that's fine. I mean, it's a Linux kernel. It runs just fine. There may be the occasional little thing that doesn't work, but for the most part, it's pretty kosher. Yes, Kevin?
Is there a particular reason you elected to go with a loopback-mounted image as a
portability. The question is, why did I use a loopback mounted file instead of like a partition or an LV or something like that? Portability. I built this actual image on my file server at home. Put it on my laptop, took it to the colo, put it on the Opteron server, and that's where it's running. That's all. If I was interested in performance, I wouldn't do this. If I wanted performance, I would do it in a logical volume. But for the sake of ease, this is far and away the easiest way to do it. Is there another question? I taught a Xen class a few weeks ago, and someone asked that question. We managed to get a DOM U running basically no services. I think it ballooned down to 13 megs before it died. And that was running without swap.
13 megs of RAM?
Yes. So, I probably could have gotten it down further if I'd gotten rid of a couple of Gettys or something. I probably could have gotten it down to 10. Yeah. Yeah, you can run a Linux system with very, very, very little RAM if you cut out enough processes. You know, you cut out the Gettys, you cut out SSH, you cut out syslog, you cut out, all sorts of things. And it's useless, can't do anything, but it's a fun little exercise. Let's see, XM, Matt, what is it? Memset?
Yeah.
Dapper test 64. All right, so I have just dropped it down to 64 meg. If I had another console, I'd be able to show that to you. But I can sit here and start dropping it down. All right, I just dropped it down to 32. Whoops, not 320. And eventually this number is going to get so low that it's not going to work anymore. All right, I just dropped it down to 16 megs of RAM. Let's just see if it's still running. All right, so... But it's a fun little exercise. But hey, it's Xen. Who cares? I didn't crash a real server. I don't give a damn. So it's fun to play with Xen and see how much you can really push the limits. If you do it in small increments, The process that Xen uses of adding and removing memory from a domain is called ballooning. If you do it slowly, it will balloon down fairly gracefully. Obviously, 16 megs is a little bit too low. I bet if I had done like 20, I probably would have gotten away with it. But, you know, c'est la vie. Anyway, running Dapper under Xen is really very straightforward. You just have to get the hang of using Dbootstrap and making a couple of modifications to the resulting file system. But after that, it's painless. It's very nice. Very nice. Yeah, Alan, question?
If you wanted to run the kernel that ships with Dapper, you would have to have some sort of modification done to that.
You have to have a Xenified kernel. You must boot the DOM U with a Xen aware kernel.
Yes, and the host have to be modified.
That's correct. So I just chose to use a Fedora Core 5 kernel as my DOM U kernel just because it was readily available and easy. I didn't feel like going to the trouble of making a Dapper Xen kernel. Big deal.
As someone who's actually tried to make a Dapper Xen kernel, it's very, very difficult with the amount of backported patches we have because we're running 2.6.15 on Dapper, whereas I think you're running 2.6.16 plus a bunch of patches. And so the number of patches that we have from 17.git and 18 and so forth and stuff that we forward-ported from our previous one just made it impossible to actually do. But, however, the next release will see a lot of work towards Xen, but since Debian's next release will be targeted for Xen, not in this current coming Ubuntu release, but the one after, will have Xen support natively.
Anyway, that's all. If you have any more Xen questions, you can catch me afterwards.
The one after is going to be Xenified.
Wait a whole bunch of years?
No, 10 months.
So if you enjoy the project, I'll help out for your next week.
Yes. Because we chose to take an extra 6 weeks to do this.
Right.
Yeah, we're squishing the release cycle now. So it'll fall back into the every 6 months again.
So that was one of the questions I was going to ask. So the next release will be Xenified.
It'll be in October.
Yeah. So I guess the other question is LTS. Is that all future releases, or are those going to be selected
ones?
Okay.
Yeah. This next one, which is the edgy code name or whatever, is supposed to have all the very, very unstable stuff like XGL and some work with Xen and so on and so forth. It's basically a playground for everybody in the community who's interested to just try and dump stuff into it and then kind of sift it out. But there's no real, okay, we're going to have an LTS release every 18 months or, you know, every 5 years or so. There's nothing like that. It's okay, the state of all the packages is kind of, yes, exactly. That's something that will be decided by the technical board.
For those of us who are already using
the 5.2,
could you maybe give us some of the highlights of what's new and cool on Dapper?
Yeah, I'm going to get to that real quick.
I noticed today that when I went into looking for new packages or updated packages that are available, that you want to upgrade as well, which I thought was interesting.
Because I accidentally kicked over that power cord, my laptop kind of shut off. But.
Yeah, for like 9% of there.
Just take a second to actually come up. Some of the things that are kind of cool are that U/ thing, that brown Ubuntu logo that shows up when you're booting. The installer, of course, the live graphical installer is pretty cool. A lot of work was put into streamlining the boot process itself, just eliminating services and just making them start up asynchronously. Like, by the time you want to get to a login screen for the display manager, you don't necessarily need to know that networking is going or not. You just want to be able to log in. So there was a lot of work done with a open source tool called Bootchart to eliminate all the stuff. And by using Bootchart, we discovered that most of the startup sequence is I/O bound. It's just chucking stuff into memory. So a lot of work was done there. What else? There was also work done on a graphical kind of network browser roaming thing called Network Manager, which I believe Red Hat is putting a lot of funding into. It is debatable whether it's really actually feasible for everybody. There are known working chipsets, like if you have a Centrino platform, it works really well with IPW drivers. But if you have some of the more off ones that require, say, the MAD Wi-Fi drivers, then they don't necessarily work all that well. But that's something, again, that will hopefully be addressed in the open source community as we contribute changes back and forth. So like I was saying before, we've streamlined the boot. We've got a new splash screen that starts up. We've got the installer. We've got a lot of work done with power management, especially if you have an IBM ThinkPad or a Lenovo or something like that. Most of the business class Dell models, some of the Toshibas, have just absolutely much better power support, power management support than it was in the previous stable release. And a lot of that stuff has been done with GNOME. So everything that the Ubuntu developers have been working on is actually in GNOME. So everybody gets that benefit. And, of course, we have updated stuff like Firefox and so on and so forth. Does that kind of address your question? That's kind of a broad overview. But what's actually up next besides what I just talked about? Well, obviously, in the next couple of releases, we're going to be looking at putting new versions of the community-supported software in there, OpenOffice, Firefox, and so on and so forth. But this is kind of a tongue-in-cheek approach at what actually drives the development here. This is the first bug that was ever filed on the bug tracker, and it says it's entitled Microsoft Has a Majority Market Share. This is probably not going to be closed within the next year or so, but of course it's, you know, a nice thing to dream about. Does anybody have any questions? Yes. Port to Power 5. Actually, it's already ported. Yeah, it actually runs on the iSeries. There's a particular flavor that runs on the iSeries. Anything? Yes.
I've heard a rumor that the next version is going to be supporting Xen directly. Is that
directly? Not for Edgy. There's not going to be enough time for Edgy. There are two people working on Xen support. One is a Google Summer of Code student, and another person is just kind of doing it in his spare time. But as far as I know, there are plans to get much better support for Xen so that you can actually go and do it in a much more streamlined sequence. But there's actually no plan to support it out of the box, per se. Any other questions? All right. That's about all I have planned. So if you have any more questions, just catch me up. I'd like to thank Jason, of course, for taking time to talk about Xen.
All right, much thanks to Dan for his talk. I know I've played around with Dapper myself and the server side of things, and it is very, very nice so far. Thanks for coming. If you have any questions for Dan or myself or any of the steering committee guys or anyone else, feel free to stick around for a little while. Next month, our talk will be on Blender, the 3D rendering stuff. That's all I know about it, but it promises there'd be lots of pretty, pretty eye candy, which we all know and love. So we hope to see you guys all next month, and thanks for coming out. That's all. Drive safe.